doesn't matter what I design. What matters is what we make.
What kind of cardboard box?
What's in the box?
What's in the box?
It loses its value if you take it out of the packaging.
Hey, packaging peeps, it's Velio Matos on Package Design Unboxed. And today we're talking to Vincent Villiger, former packaging director of Burberry and current luxury designer for brands such as Dunhill, Dior, Molton Brown, and pretty much basically any brand that you think of when you envision luxury. That's Vincent's sweet spot. Now, this conversation revolves around luxury packaging, what it means, what it is, and even what it's not. Now, I've known Vincent for many years, and in this conversation, I learned a ton about his process and his approach to designing packaging for luxury brands. Whether you're designing packaging for a startup, a luxury brand, an in-house team for an F&B brand, you're going to walk away with at least three things from this episode. Number one, how being a designer isn't just about visual design. It's about learning the craft behind the manufacturing of everything that you work with. Papers, boards, foils, everything. Number two, packaging isn't a separate item from the product. Vincent explains how he designs the packaging from the same perspective as the product. So making packaging the product. And number three, Vincent also breaks down his design process. He talks about how he works with materials first. Why materials? Because materials communicate the brand before the unboxing even happens. He explains how that approach helped achieve Burberry's objectives. Plus, there's a ton more to learn from Vincent. I mean, the guy's a master when it comes to packaging. Now, before we get to the show, I want you to do me a favor. If you're on Apple Podcasts, hit the plus symbol. And if you're on Spotify, follow us and hit the bell icon. I'm super excited to get to this episode, so let's just get to it. All right, guys, thanks a lot.
We have Vincent Villiger. I pronounced that correctly, Villiger.
I was going to say congratulations on pronouncing the name right. You're one in very few people who do that.
And Vincent, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what your role is in the world of packaging?
Sure. Really, I'm a creative. So I'm a packaging designer. I trained 20 plus years ago as a product designer. So at heart, really, I'm a product guy. And I fell into packaging really by accident. And in the last 20 years, my career has kind of gone, you know, more and more niche to the point where I'm now really specializing in the design of packaging for the luxury and beauty industries. So designing things like perfume bottles or retail packaging for luxury brands.
How does product design relate to packaging?
My background in product design is really influencing my practice when it comes to packaging design. So my brain is very much three-dimensional, and I think a lot about materials and tactility and three-dimensionality. And I find that has really worked well for me. That's translated really well in the world of packaging design.
Can you give me a little bit of idea of who you've worked with?
Sure. I studied in Paris initially before then going to do a master's in London. So I'm based in London as well, I should say. And really, my first commercial design, my first design that I produced, which was commercialized, was for Issey Miyake perfumes. It was a tiny little gift with purchase set, which I designed at the weekend and got signed off on a Tuesday by Issey Miyake. So that was great news for me. And it was really the project that set me on the path with my career, because from then on, I started then designing for, you know, other people at Issey Miyake. And these people then moved on and ended up being MDs at Givenchy Perfumes and Yves Saint Laurent, Boucheron, Van Cleef & Arpels, all those really prestigious Paris beauty brands and fashion brands. And so I found myself doing work for these guys really as a side project, aside from my full-time job. I had a full-time role in London designing accessories for a homeware company. And it came to a point where actually the freelance became more important than the full-time job. And so I transitioned to doing that full-time, set up with my wife. And from there, we started really designing things like, you know, promotional gift sets, bottle flankers for all these brands. So, you know, from a makeup compact for Givenchy to the refillable bottle for them as well. We did a purse spray for Opium, which was a great franchise to be working on. you know, travel retail, lots of travel retail kits for Van Cleef & Arpels, Issey Miyake's, all those really familiar, prestigious brands. And we, my wife and I, we did that for a few years quite happily, and it was working well. And we did that up until 2008. And of course, the financial crisis struck then, and business was still coming in, but we could sense that the clients were wanting, increasingly wanting more for less. And it coincided with the time that Burberry in London tapped me on the shoulder, and they were building an in-house creative studio, and they needed somebody to build the packaging design function. And so this is when I transitioned to a full-time role at Burberry, building and leading the packaging design function, which I did for 8 years. And that was a great period in my professional life, because it was a very dynamic period for the brand. You know, there was new people at the top, new mandate to really turn the brand into an amazing luxury brand. And I was brought in because of that knowledge in packaging, which nobody else in the business had. So that was a great 8 years, building a team, training a few people, and having amazing opportunities to redesign the retail packaging entirely. We did that two or three times over my tenure, redesigning the entire portfolio of fragrances. So these opportunities that, you know, a few years before you could only dream of, now they were like, they kept coming in every month. So it was a really privileged 8 years in my career. And all the while, also, I was learning an incredible amount, because you were working next to people at the best in London at whatever they were doing. So you were working with graphic designers; they were the best in London. You were working with art directors; they were the best in London. So you find yourself learning by osmosis, I've really enjoyed it. 8 years was a long, long stint.
It's really interesting in terms of coming into a brand of that size, to build a packaging team, to build an in-house team. How did you approach building a team, and what type of designers were you looking for? How did you hire?
I hired versions of me, basically, which may or may not have been the right thing to do. But I hired people at a very junior level. My first recruit, I hired her straight from her degree show. So I went to see the degree show. And what I was looking for was attitude as much as creative skills.
And were those graphic designers or industrial designers?
This was industrial design. And maybe it's because I can understand it, so I find it easier for me to gauge somebody's skill set from a discipline that I could understand. But it was also really simple things like, you know, the course tutor had lined up, I think, five or six of their best students to meet me. And out of these, you have the students that don't bother turning up. And then you have the ones that aren't on the list, but really make sure they want to speak to you, which I like as well. So you get to see how people will behave in the real world as well as just purely how good a designer they are as a student, which is only really half the story.
Yesterday, I spoke to Arizona State, just explaining to the students how to get out in front of people, how to put together your portfolio, and how important it is to show up, right? Because if you don't show up, you miss the opportunity. So it's great to hear that it's the same thing at a brand like Burberry, you know, and that's the same case showing up.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there are things you can teach and things you can't, and positive attitude isn't something that I think is for me to teach people. I'd rather find somebody who has that positive attitude, and we can work on the process and on creativity and on all these things. But you know, I've been quite fortunate. I've managed to find really good people and build a really good team.
You've talked about doing some packaging that I would consider primary packaging, so like the bottles and the caps and those types of systems. Can you expound on what packaging is and what packaging isn't?
Yeah, so you're right. I work on primary and secondary. In fairness, I know like a perfume bottle is considered packaging by people. For me, it's product, you know, by the nature of the materials you use and the production process that you use and the fact you're going to combine multiple materials, that's product. So for me, you know, I don't really make the distinction. Even if box are designed, I think of it as a product. It's got a function to serve. It's going to use multiple materials. It's going to be subject to manufacturing constraints. So really, it's a subdivision of product design. What it isn't is slapping graphics on a box, you know, and I think that's where we'll see a lot of people fall short or brands fall short, is underestimating how specific a skill set packaging design can be. And I often say, you know, there is a lot more to designing packaging than printing graphics on a box.
Yeah, you're right. For packaging, you don't always have to create a custom structure, but just making sure that you're even selecting the appropriate structure for the product itself and for the experience. But you're doing a lot of extremely custom packaging and custom making papers and custom making foils.
How deep does your process go?
as deep as people will let me, really. I think it's true what you say. It's really about the creation of an experience. You know, packaging is a physical expression of the brand's values. And so if you can achieve that by using stock structures and stock materials, then happy days. And sometimes, you know, that's part of the constraint. You know, not every brand will have the budgets to go bespoke. But I've been really fortunate that a lot of the projects I've been working on, that's been an opportunity. That's been part of the brief to create bespoke materials. And I really enjoy doing it. So working with mills, and I've worked with mills in the US, I've worked with mills in Germany, Scotland, England, and you get to really work with companies that are centuries old, with people who are incredibly skilled. And, you know, I love production. So for me, if it's part of, you know, a tool that will help you tell the right story, then absolutely, it's a key part of what I do. The material is the first thing I'll be looking at when I design packaging. So you're asking about my process. Material probably comes first. So recently, the most recent example of that is with Molton Brown, where we developed a couple of bespoke shades for them, direct paper mills, and then I developed bespoke textures for the packs. Traveling to Italy to the converters to really literally chat with the guy who's operating the embossing machine and challenge him on, you know, can we have more pressure? Can we do it more like this, more like that, to get the result we wanted? A lot of the time, it's about just having the right level of knowledge that you can challenge people, but also the right level of ignorance you know, that you can have that sort of naivety that says, should we just try it anyway, kind of thing. And so it's that that pivot between concept production is really where I operate. But I love developing materials. You know, developing materials is probably one of my favorite things in my job. So it's just great fun. You know, for Burberry, we worked on a material, the paper, which was to really replicate the fabric, the gabardine fabric, which we use for the trench coats. And so it's about really finding the exact right shade, the exact right texture. You know, paper is a very different animal in terms of how material behaves compared to fabric. So, you know, it's how do you find the tricks to make it feel the same when actually they're a completely different structure. So it goes quite deep, you know, and then it's, you know, how do we manage that embossing when, you know, if you make it too deep, you're going to shred your paper. If it's not deep enough, you can't see it.
International Direct Packaging is the only factory direct packaging manufacturer with global showrooms. They design and produce packaging for established luxury brands. Because IDP's team of packaging experts design and manufacture packaging, you get a more transparent supply chain. You're also not going to be paying distributor markups. Find the nearest IDP showroom to schedule your first packaging consultation at idpdirect.com. Because IDP doesn't source factories, they are the factory. idpdirect.com.
So it's all of those things that you find yourself knowing far too much about.
You bring up many great points there with the Burberry paper. So the idea of matching the gabardine fabric, and for anybody that doesn't know, it's a really coarse weave that you see. And you can feel it. And it's great on fabric, But when you try to replicate that on paper, you're getting involved into the science behind this, as well as the how much recycled content. And I apologize, there's a helicopter going over my house.
They finally found me.
They found me. But are you getting involved in the length of the fibers that are going in there, or are you leaving that to the paper mill to decide how to match that texture?
I get involved in the sense that I will review options. So, and we will have conversations about, you know, if you use more recycled material in the paper, you're going to get shorter fibers. Mm-hmm. What's the impact of that on the structural integrity of your material? What's the impact of it, you know, being able to be embossed? What's the impact on the color and how much color consistency you can achieve? So all of these things, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's part of what I enjoy. I also have really good production houses that I work very closely with. And so we've been working together for years, which means that, you know, we have a great dialogue. And so it's not just kind of me, you know, delivering all these things. It's working with people who are experts at what they're doing at the mills, people who understand production left, right, and center. And together we develop these amazing materials.
So for the gabardine texture, before you even start developing the paper, where does the idea even come from to mimic in the packaging?
That was really part of the brand strategy at the time, which was focused on the iconic product. You know, part of where the brand had been diluted was it had been heavily licensed, so you could get Burberry everything. And so it was really about refocusing, and the trench coat was going to be this iconic product that we were going to push. And so it's really down to something that I think is really important in packaging design, is being clear on what your objective is. Because, you know, when you start with a blank page, it could be anything. And so you need to be clear what your objective is. And here it was really about contributing to the elevation of the trench coat as this iconic product, which the brand was going to revolve around. So once you put it like that, in terms of what your objective is, from a creative perspective, it's not a great leap to go, well, let's just make the packaging look like the product.
How important do you think it is for packaging designers to view packaging as product and experiential?
I think it's only important if you want to be good at it.
So if you want to be a bad packaging designer, then don't worry about it.
You know, the short answer is I don't know. I know it's worked for me.
Sure.
You know, and it's worked because it's provided a bit of a point of difference compared to a lot of other people. But equally, you know, up until a few years ago, packaging wasn't something you would learn in university, packaging design. So you were either a graphic designer or a product designer or an engineer. You know, and so it wasn't a thing. So you had to figure it out. So you could either come at it from a graphic angle, you came at it from a product angle, or you came at it from an engineering angle. You know, it's evolved mm-hmm. now, and you get courses that are a lot more tailored to packaging design, and which cover aspects of production. But you know,
so you having been in-house at Burberry, and then now your freelance agency essentially. You've been on both sides. Do you find that it makes it easier to communicate with the clients that you're working with? I know that when I've worked with different brands, you know, I might be working today with a creative director at a brand who understands design and knows the value in what packaging brings. But at the same time, I might be working with a different brand, and instead of speaking with design, I'm mostly speaking with procurement and the people behind finance. How do you communicate with each of those different types of people?
It's true that it's a big part of the appeal of my profile for brands, is that I understand how brands function. And so I know what brands care about, what matters to brands when it comes to packaging design. And I understand, you know, procurement functions, and I understand development functions, and I understand what each of these guys is after. You know, and there's a real benefit of that. So you, all those years spent around the table with your purchasing guy and with your engineer and with your marketing guy, all trying to achieve a great result, but each with their own set of KPIs is really useful. So even though I'm technically an agency now, but I really like to think of myself as an envoy within the brand. Mm-hmm. I'm so comfortable operating in-house. And so what I do is I don't go in and say, I'm going to deliver this for you. I enjoy instead working with the functions that are in place. But what I do is I'll say, I will help you talk to each other. So traditionally, marketing teams and development teams, don't always see eye to eye. And so it's useful for them to have a third party who is an outsider, sits in the middle, speaks both languages, and help mediate to make the project happen. So I'm able to, tell, again, it's that knowing enough that you can have the conversation. So I know enough that I've got credibility with the development teams. So when I ask for something, they know that it's not coming entirely out of, creative ego. But I also know enough about it that I can tell the marketing guys, no, trust me, you want this thing to be square. It can't be square. It can't be blue, and all of a sudden they're able to accept that. So that's a role that's working really well. It's really helping projects come to good fruition. One thing also that I really enjoy about the in-house elements of being on the brand side rather than agency side is the longevity. You're doing things to build something. You're building a brand, you've got objectives, and you've got longer term ambitions. So it's never about just this project. It's always about how this project will fit within the greater ambitions of the brand. And again, I think that resonates well with my clients, that I'm never in it just for that one project and let's make that one project amazing. It's always about let's just make this project into the foundation for the next thing that you're going to need to be doing.
You have to have that long-term view. But I think it's interesting in that you're the bridge between creative and finance or creative and marketing. Because it's true within a lot of these brands, those teams don't typically collaborate. They're usually at odds with each other. I know for me just working with a brand not too long ago, the creative team sat in one building and then the finance team sat in a different build, like literally in two different buildings. And they didn't speak to each other. And they creative was finance's headache and finance was creative's headache. But when you go in there and you're able to talk to both of them and bring them to the table and let them both understand that you have both their best interests in mind, that the goal for everybody is to move the brand forward. Mm-hmm. For me personally, it's always a really fun moment to get finance involved and even show, showing them sketches and showing them materials and getting their feedback as an outsider and pulling them into the process. You find that everybody on the team has great ideas. And once they're bought into the process, they might be able to find a little bit more budget for that decision that they were a part of versus just coming to them, putting something on their table and saying, this is how much it costs and this is what you're responsible for. Do you find yourself bringing in those non-creatives or non-design stakeholders into your process?
Totally. In fact, that was one of the first conversations we had with Molton Brown. I suggested and I said to them, let's make sure we get the development team involved when we're about 80% sure what we want to do with the design. So mm-hmm. we know enough what we want to do that it's not completely intangible for these guys because they need something to work from. But let's leave enough flex that they're able to operate and do their thing rather than just put something on the table and say to them, this is what we need to do come hell or high water. And I agree. I think you find that then people feel a lot more engaged. You get much better response out of people. And also you haven't locked yourself into decisions that you've made without knowing all the full facts. So I agree. And that's worked really well for me. It's, all these people in all the teams, they're all good people and they all know exactly what they're doing with their bit. It's really about making sure that all those bits fit together. Mm-hmm. And it's where a lot of the fun is. That's the bit they don't teach you in design college, that's for sure.
Right. That's where the fun is. And I find myself you know, my network is, there's a lot of designers, but it's just as many procurement or development people that are non-design are in that process, in that network, because you do build such great relationships with everyone. And I think once somebody that's typically just focused on the finance of it has a say in your design process, they see why it's so much fun, and they see why you're so passionate about the decisions that you're making, and they see the value that you're bringing. So it's just important, I think, for designers, whether they're graphic designers, web designers, packaging designers, to not only focus on the creative teams, but look at finance, look at the business, and understand how the design that you're creating is going to deliver these KPIs for all these different departments and move that brand forward. Mm.
It would be inconceivable for me now to do a project and just hand over a concept CAD and walk away. You know, I will always, now the way I structure even my quotes, my proposals, mm-hmm. always includes me being part of that development stage as a support function, because I've come to really view that development stage as 100% a creative stage. You make so many decisions along the way of, actually, we can't make this piece that way, or we can't achieve this exact finish, or, you know, those two bits can't connect like this. And so you're constantly having to adjust and understand the impact of this decision on that other aspect of your design. And that's a creative process. And by being part of it, you're able really to reduce the gap as much as possible between your original vision and the end product that comes out of the factory line. And
absolutely.
And that's, for me, is where the crux of it is. You can find a lot of people who will produce a lot of wonderful, amazing designs, but it's, for me, the skill is in how you make sure that what you make is as close as possible to the vision. One of my things is always say, you know, it doesn't matter what I design. What matters is what we make.
So it's just a really important role, I think, for packaging designers, is to understand all the aspects of the business, the development side and the production side, and how to bring it all together, right? Because if I come up with a beautiful idea and you can't manufacture it, it's pointless and it's worthless. So I love the experience that you've pulled together from the production side, being involved in the paper, being involved in the print, and how to develop all these different things to create complete bespoke packaging, but then also able to, on the flip side, work with the development and work with finance and all those things. And you're right, those are the things that they don't teach at university. So when you're working with a new team, for example, let's say you're brought into a new client and you're sitting across the table from a team that isn't made up of designers, what are the things that you typically want to make sure that they know about you and your process before you start on a project?
One of the things is I really always encourage people to think about the value of packaging. You can find yourself very quickly going into a conversation about how long is it going to take, how much is it going to cost. And I always try and flip that conversation to, when we're done, how valuable will this thing be? You know, so if you create a piece of packaging that doubles your retention rate on your website, for instance, or, you know, halves the rate of returns that you get, how much is that worth to you? You know, how much marketing budget would you have to spend to achieve those same figures? So it's kind of the first thing I want is people to understand that packaging is a value adding component and not just a cost. Dead cost to them. Once we've established that, we're able to have much more meaningful conversation. Then I also try and make sure that they understand what I'm about. You know, so are they clear on what I can bring? Like, are they clear on what I, you know, what my influences will be? What my, you know, what I'm going to bring to the table? You know, you don't want, the last thing you want is for somebody to kind of have me working on an outer pack, and then they're scratching their heads thinking who's going to design the bottle, and not realizing that actually this is what I do. So it's making sure they have a clear picture of me as a person. You know, what's my experience, what's my influences, what's my cultural references, And also it's a way to ensure that you're going to have good compatibility between you and the project. So early on, I try and really explain to them that, you know, play back to them what I understand their brief to be, so they can be reassured that I understand it, and then explain to them why, from my experience, I'm the right person for that job. And then finally, I always make sure that we're super clear on the objectives before we start. You know, why are you doing this? What are you trying to achieve? What story are you trying to tell? That's the question I asked Bolton Brown in the first meeting. What story are you trying to tell? And out of the four or five people around the table, you'll get four or five different answers. And that's, again, where the fun begins. And you know, you start the dialogue like that. And, you know, it's just a much more interesting approach than jumping straight into the creative. But also it means that down the line, you're able to really assess your designs against a much more objective set of criteria, rather than, well, the director likes it. And it's like, well, yes, but your brief is to deliver
this. He's not the customer.
You know, so, and also sometimes there are three things that we like, and you know, we only need one. So how do you make that decision? So being clear on your objectives is absolutely something that I've learned to establish before you put pen to paper, because if not, you can waste everybody's time very quickly.
It isn't about pleasing one person in the brand. It's about moving that brand forward. So have you had that discussion before? Have you had have you come across that where somebody on the team says, I like this, and they start pushing for that idea, but without knowing how or why they like that?
Well, the flip side of that, is that in the world of luxury and fashion, the success of brands is a lot of the time driven by having a super talented individual at the top who may not be able to rationalize why this is great, but you know, 9 times out of 10 it is. So you've got the rational part of me, you know, I will absolutely want to know why we're doing this. But I've also learned, you know, and it's that 8 years at Burberry, to actually trust your creative instinct. I guess it's back to your point about, is this person the customer or is this person the decision maker? And if they are, then fair enough. You know, if they are the brand and if they are the end decision maker, then that's one thing. If you're dealing with somebody who is going to be an intermediary in the decision making process, then that's a very different thing. But you know, I've got wonderful memories of working with all the senior creative teams at Burberry, where, you know, I would try and post rationalize the decisions to make sure that, you know, I had this real objective reason as to why I thought this box should be green, and of them telling me, you know, it's okay, we can just do it in green because we love it, you know, and that's enough. I haven't really been used to doing focus groups, for instance. I'm not comfortable with focus groups. I'd much rather come to the table with a point of view. And I think that's to do with being involved in the luxury market, where I think a lot of the time you do things that are new and you tap into, you know, new cultural references or a new mood of society, rather than trying to really optimize sales for this or that category. And so it's more important to come in with a confident point of view than it is to make sure you're pleasing as many people as possible. So, you know, I'm aware that, you know, producing a perfume bottle for a high-end brand is very different to designing a label for a can of beans, you know.
I just find it difficult to move forward with focus, and design teams, marketing teams really, really count on them. But it's important, I think, to have a point of view and to be able to see that designer's point of view come across in the packaging.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I get why some you know, why it's right sometimes. You know, you've got massive investments. You know, in the world of beauty, you're going to do like launch like skincare range. Like, you want to know you're going to get it right, and it's a good insurance policy. But I don't think it should drive a creative process. I think it's. But you know, I may be wrong. I don't know. It's just I don't work particularly well with them. I'd rather just, you know, I kind of take the view that in a brand, you in the room that makes the decisions, you'll have the four or five people who know what the brand is. And I think you have to just trust these people to make the right call for their brand.
what is luxury packaging, right? What defines luxury packaging? Is it the brand name, or is it the experience that, that goes into that? You know, what are the three things that, that luxury packaging should strive to have?
Well, I spoke about the point of view, and I think for me, that's the first thing. You know, it's a brand that knows what it stands for and has that confidence to express that one clear message. That's why a lot of the time, it can look a bit alien or shocking when, you know, like fashion does what it does, because it's about that point of view, and that point of view is going to be very forward. So that needs to come with a degree of confidence. It's about knowing what you want to say and the confidence to stay quiet as well. So from a visual perspective, that will translate itself with choices that will translate those values. Sometimes they'll be quite bold in terms of the aesthetic, rather than being like a Me Too version of something else that already exists. But also it'll be typically very quiet and restrained. So it's, again, it's back to the difference between a box for a high-end fashion label versus a can of bean on a supermarket shelf. You know, they've got very different jobs to do. You know, so the can of beans is about standout, visibility, super clear hierarchy, making sure that you understand what flavoring is, so range navigation, all those really kind of practical elements. And then on top of that, you're going to need to really optimize your margin. So you're going to be looking at really cheap production cost. Whereas in the luxury world, it's really about what are the values of the brand? What does the brand stand for? So is it about a technological, embracing technological advances? Or is it about, the tradition of this weaving or that kind of craft? Or, you know, so it's about explaining all this, but making your consumer feel it rather than explaining it. So it's about the tactility and the visual aspect rather than the words. The second thing really is timelessness. I think one of the elements that characterizes the way I approach design is that timelessness. So I'm never hell-bent on reinventing the wheel, and I'm not particularly chasing newness. But I always, when I design something, I always look at, will this still look good in 5-10 years time? Will I still love it in 5-10 years time? You know, will it still make sense? So that really drives me away from short-term trends. And, you know, it works for packaging because you've got typically big tooling investments, longer shelf life on your items. So you can't afford to be too time specific. And there are ways that you can do that. So, you know, there are ways that you can adapt your packaging to, you know, and we see it for seasonality, for instance, or campaign. So you can play, but your baseline should have that element of timelessness. I always give the example, you know, people say to me, oh, Hermes is amazing. It's that orange box. I say, exactly. You know, how annoyed would you be if you'd saved the whole year to buy your mom a Hermes scarf? And when you get to purchasing it, you get a blue box because they've decided that at Christmas the box is blue. You know, you want the orange box. So that timelessness is important. And then finally, it's that excellence in production. So as much as I'm not particularly going to be chasing newness, and I don't get excited by the latest fancy pop-up structure, you know, I won't tolerate a misaligned edge or a poor color match or a fold that isn't crisp, you know. So all that energy that could be spent in reinventing the wheel again, I'd rather focus it on achieving an amazing execution standard, and that goes a much longer way. And for me, that speaks to luxury a lot more than newness for the sake of it.
So as packaging designers, do you feel that they should be looking at the final product on a consistent basis, and, you know, looking at those edges, looking at those folds, making sure that things are correct? And if they're not, that they should speak up, and, you know, and how do they speak up to the production team? You know, how do they speak up to the factory?
So the first part of the question is, yes, absolutely. I think you need to care about it, because
it's back to that. It doesn't matter what you design, you know, your consumer will see what you've made. And I always want to be able to be proud of what I've been a part of making. And so if the end product isn't to the standard that I'm happy with, then I can't show it to another client. I can't show it to my next client and say, hey, I've made that. Because if they say, well, look, it's really shabby, you're like, well, you know, that's not my design. that's no good to anyone. So yes, definitely, I think you do need to care. And the way that you push back is by having the right standards, is knowing that actually this isn't as good as I want it to be. But then the other side of that is having an understanding of, a basic understanding of production, so that you're able to push back because you know it can be better. And there's a lot of times where I've had those conversations with the clients where, you know, I've said, it could be that your current supplier or that your supplier you've picked, that's the best they can do, but that's not the best that can be done. So is this the right supplier for this project? But that comes with the confidence that, you know, you can evaluate the standard of something against what is possible. And it's pushing. You have to find the right balance between, you know, how much of it is helpful and how much of it is getting in the way of getting stuff done. You know, so you have when you've pushed it enough. But you know, that's where typically the role of the outsider is useful, you know, and there's a way to go about getting what you want as well. You know, you can be a bit charming about it, you can be a little bit tongue in cheek about it. For me, that works quite well. But that there has to be an underlying of, okay, this guy understands what we're facing, or he understands how this works. Therefore, I'm prepared to listen and give it a go. Whereas if you come in with complete naivety, you just bang your fist on the table because you don't think it's good enough. If you haven't got the credibility, then it's going to be a lot harder for you to get your voice heard. So start by understanding what the challenge is, you know, like whether it's the guy at the machine, you know, do they need it to run faster? What are the challenges? Is there anything that can give? You know, which bits do you care about the most and how do you deliver this? But pushing is, yeah, it's, you know, there's times where I haven't been everybody's favorite in the room, you know, when you're in Italy in the kind of manufacturer's meeting room and you're reviewing things. You have to be prepared to be unpopular.
When I first started in design, I was lucky enough to spend a couple of years working at a bindery house where they were actually producing packaging and folding and watching machines and being a part of that process. So I was able to learn a lot of that early on. And then as I continued to grow in my career, just being able to work with different companies and manufacturers and learn all these processes. But I tell a lot of the students that I work with, as unsexy as it is, you have to go in and learn all of this production. And that it's important, you're right, that you should care about the end result. Because I see a lot of websites, a lot of portfolios that have beautiful 3D renderings that are crisp and pixel perfect. But when they actually show you what the final result was, you're right, there's some misalignment. There's you know, some type of offset on emboss and a foil. And there's all these details that are not good. But the response that I get back is, well, my design was perfect, execution wasn't great, right? And that's the chasm, that's that gap that is really important, and it separates a junior designer, I think, from an experienced designer, is that you're able to push back and you're able to manage both the design and the production side.
There's projects where I don't even do a drawing. You know, I'll sketch it for myself. Mm-hmm. But I won't have a stage where I present a CAD to a client. So I will go straight to sampling actual and have call off actual materials, do foiling tests, so that the first meeting I have with a client is with actual physical materials rather than looking at a PDF on screen. As much as possible, I just try and bypass the screen stage.
So I think to get more current, right? We're both on lockdown because of coronavirus, and you know, I'm in Arizona in my house, and you're in London in yours. Do you feel that this coronavirus lockdown, that everything that retail is experiencing at the moment, do you feel that this is going to change packaging in somehow?
I really want it to.
I want it to impact the way we operate. I feel like it's got the potential to last long enough that it actually enables us to change our habits. So, you know, if you change the way you do things for a week, you will go back to the way you used to do things, right? But change the way you do things for a few months, you're much more likely to stick with it. And I'm hoping we see a bit of that, you know, whether it's companies embracing remote working a lot more than they have been. But, you know, it's going to be a cultural shift. So I think we will see an impact in all aspects. But I'm really looking forward to it. I think, you know, it's a tricky one because it's a real tough one, and you know it affects, you know, people's health massively. For me, the main takeaway has been how quickly we can change things. So when you see businesses changing their production facilities to produce different types of items, or when you see legislation go through super quick and being fast-tracked, you know, watching this kind of crisis management come into place at all levels of society, from government to companies to individuals. And I find it really inspiring when you see how quickly that can change. And for me, it feels like the next logical step is to challenge why we don't operate as quickly more often. Obviously, there's a massive cost to operating in a crisis mode, and that's not sustainable. I'm not suggesting that's how it should always be, but certainly in the context of the previous big thing that everybody used to care about, which was sustainability, it makes you wonder why none of that sort of crisis mode has been present. And I think when we come out of the other side of the coronavirus crisis, we'll start looking back on sustainability and think, well, actually, we know now that we can have a positive impact, that we can change our habits drastically, that not everything needs to take 5 years, and why can't it happen quicker? So I think that's one area where I'm hoping we'll see, you know, we will see an impact, is that belief that actually we can change things in a dramatic way very quickly.
So from a visual design and a branding standpoint, do you see packaging changing much after the virus, similar to what we saw in 2008 after the meltdown that we had?
I think you might. You know, you'll see it in all aspects of culture. You'll definitely see it in fashion. You'll see it in so that will transpire in everything. You know, more short term, you're seeing a massive evolution now in e-com packaging. So you're seeing all the adverts now on your feed. I'm sure you are as well, with everybody suddenly advertising the fact that they can do e-com packaging. It's like, hey, you know, we introduce your shipping boxes. So I think we'll see. We're seeing a bit of that now, definitely. But I think it'll be interesting. It will be interesting. I think if I'm honest, at the moment, my brain has been on how to get over it myself, rather than what will the impact be on the aesthetics of packaging. I think I'm like you. I'm probably trying to make sure my kid doesn't turn too feral. And
the only thing I can relate to is this last crisis that we had, the banking crisis, and everything after that. You know, retail changed in that a lot of the brands reduced the size of their logo. They made their packaging not be so
ostentatious.
Exactly, right. They wanted to simplify things so that you weren't out on the street flaunting luxury to people that have just lost their homes, lost their jobs. Yeah, and in this case, you know, had loved ones that they've lost their lives, or you know, they've lost their livelihood. So I'm curious to see how this pans out after the virus, and what kind of impact we'll have on visual design in general.
Yeah, you and me both. Let's bring it on.
Let's do it. So Vincent, it's been great. It's been great talking to you, man. I always enjoy chatting with you. If people want to find out more about you, where can they find you?
I'm addicted to Instagram, so that's a good place to find me. On Instagram, I'm on VV_luxurypackaging. LinkedIn is a good one as well. You can hit me up on that, or the website vincentvillager.net.
Okay, absolutely. And I'll have links to everything in the show notes. And then just one last thing, you released some Tanagrams and a yo-yo and a bunch of other products. How's that going?
Yeah, so that's been really fun. So that's really the part of me that wants to go back to doing a bit more product design and also understand the sort of challenges that my clients are facing. So obviously, you know, in-house at Burberry, it's a massive company and it's a massive business, and that's one thing. But I also have a lot of my clients are now startups, and so I wanted to really be able to relate to the sort of things that they're having to consider. So I thought actually to launch a small range of products like that would be a great way for me to learn, you know. So that's been fun. Yeah, I'm working on stage two of that now. So, you know, packaging up all the learnings from that first stage and thinking about stage two. I've got great ideas for that. But really the idea with it is to speak to that timelessness that we spoke about and to this kind of need for like an analog beauty and something that's fun, that's not reinventing the wheel, but treated in a contemporary way. And so it's kind of a collection of all the things that I love packaged up together. So it's bringing me a lot of joy, and I'm really looking forward to evolving the stage two. I think stage two is going to be based a lot more on collaboration with amazing craft people. So keep an eye out for that.
Well, Vincent, it's been great. It's been great talking to you, man. I really appreciate your time. And we'll talk soon.
All right. You take care and good luck with the podcast.
All right, packaging peeps, that's the episode. Thank you so much, Vincent, for being on. And thanks to you for listening. We'll talk soon.